Hello, and welcome to episode 9 of the Tribune podcast. My name is Stefan Binkowski, and today I'm joined by Ross Dunbar, and we are going to be taking a look back at Euro 2016, and specifically how Germany and their coach Jogi Löw did in the European Championships. Was that a spectacular failure? Was it a triumphant success? Or most likely, was it something a little in between? Ross, hi.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm good, how are you?
I'm doing very well. Let's just get jumped straight into it. Okay, postmortem Euro 2016. What's your top line in terms of, if I can use a journalism expression, what's your top line of Germany's competition?
I think given that they were probably tournament favourites, you'd have to say that it's a disappointment that they haven't got to the final. Then, obviously, the tournament has panned out, and we've seen how the draw has panned out, and obviously all the kind of competitors were on the one side of the draw, so you have to factor in that into the final reckoning. I think the kind of irony is that in the semi-final that Germany lost against France, that was probably their best performance of the tournament. Up until that point, I must admit, I wasn't really that impressed at all. I thought they were pretty disappointing. They struggled to find a solution to the big problem at the tournament, was how do you break down teams that set up predominantly to defend. That's obviously one of the downsides of having an extended tournament, but it's the problem that Germany have to face in qualification, and in qualification Germany generally don't really have a lot of problems getting past these teams, but at the European Championships they seem to have a little bit of an issue. I think let's start predominantly with the selection point of view.
Before we get into that, I kind of agree with you. It's interesting you say that, you know, the way that the competition was put together this summer. I actually thought it was a horrendous competition. And if any of our listeners follow me on Twitter, they're probably sick of me complaining about this, but I thought the expanded format was horrendous. I feel quite guilty because when it first came out, this was being expanded. I was actually quite I was quite positive because I thought, gosh, Scotland might actually make it. So I was all for it. You know, you thought, oh, it's good to have these small nations get their moment in the limelight, but at the end of the day, sport is entertainment, and these small teams largely didn't entertain. Even teams like Iceland, who, you know, their story was great, I still found them exceptionally boring to watch more often than not. And that also then adds to the actual football, in the sense that so many teams were defensive. The Northern Ireland game that Germany played, full credit to Northern Ireland. Hey, as a Scot, I have nothing but admiration for the way that Michael O'Neill put that team together. And the way that they stuck to their guns, and sure they didn't get past the group stages, but they still did remarkably well. They have a lot to be proud of. But as a neutral, I couldn't care less, and I found it so boring. From that point of view, that also then leads on to the way that their seeding was done, and the way that all the big guns were in the one half of the, I don't understand why they couldn't have done a draw each round. Is it just simple timing, maybe? Why can't they just?
Well, we wouldn't really have a lot of these criticisms if the draw wasn't seeded.
Yes.
For the last 16, then you would have had an open draw, so we wouldn't have this problem where Portugal were able to go through to the final without winning a game. And to be honest, they weren't a particularly good side. I didn't think they were defensively a good side. Mm. I know they were going off in a massive tangent here, but obviously it feeds into the way that Germany had to play, because you know, the different types of games
and the teams they had to play.
Yeah.
If the competition,
they've put Slovakia after the group stages.
Sure, it doesn't really matter when they play France or when they play Italy, they still have to beat these teams, but it is a simple fact that they had to beat Italy, then what, 3 days later they had to play France, which played a role. And it played a part in the injuries, which I think were a huge part of the manner in which Germany did ultimately fail. They lost Khedira, who I think was a huge player. Mats Hummels, Boateng. I know Boateng only came on, was only missed half a game technically, against France. And of course Gomez. Let's get into the meat and bones of this then. Let's look at, we went over the initial thoughts. You think ultimately it was disappointing. I probably agree with you. I think Germany, a lot of people touted France as the favourites. I thought that was a little, I wasn't too sure. They hadn't proved themselves at all in competitive games. I wasn't sure if that team didn't really seem to have any chemistry to me. And I thought I was ultimately proved right. It's weird because even though France beat Germany, I still thought, going into the game, I thought Germany would win quite comfortably. And even though France won the game, I actually thought the points I made beforehand actually happened. Germany still controlled the game. Germany probably should have still won it 2-0 or 3-0, but they didn't. And I think it was ultimately it was Portugal who ended up proving that France weren't the great team. I think Germany should have won the competition, and they didn't. So therefore, it is a failure. So let's get into it then. You were about to jump into selection. I mean, we can talk about Lowe specifically later on, but. It seemed a lot of key players didn't seem to show up in this competition.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, in terms of the squad call-ups, I mean, this is probably kind of one of my main criticisms of Jogi Löw was I didn't see much of a plan in the attacking sense. From defence to midfield, they were fine. You know, it picks itself. But you know, we obviously have seen Draxler come into the limelight at this tournament. Götze obviously has started as the false nine. There's a lot to be about Thomas Müller, and then beneath that you have the younger guys who came in, Sané, Weigl, Kimmich, and then Schürrle was involved, Podolski was involved. Now, I can understand why Podolski was in there, because I know that people want to believe that you can just throw all these young guys into the squad and we can just base it on talent, but it's not really how it works. You need to have a balance, you need to have players who understand, you know, these high-pressure situations. And Podolski, for all his flaws, he's been there, he's done it. You can afford to have one guy in the squad.
He's like Lowe's lieutenant, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have a problem with that. I do have an issue with Andrew Schürrle being in the squad, though, because he doesn't really offer a lot. And this Germany team, the big flaw in this Germany team for me was it lacked players who were good in one-on-one situations. It's a huge part of football nowadays. It's great that, you know, you can have a good tactical setup, you can good, you know, good positioning in the team, and that was fine. That was all there, because the players were good enough. But didn't have players who could do the business in the last third. Didn't have a number 9 striker. So I think you can take issue with some of the players that were called up in that squad. Mario Gomez, I know that he actually turned out better than he was. I think Andre Hahn should have probably got a call up potentially as a striker. I think he would have given them a little bit more of a bit more depth in attack, because he's good in the air, he's strong, he's aggressive.
A few people suggested Hahn.
Could have been an option,
you know?
Right? I mean, I understand hindsight is a wonderful thing that we can make these kind of comments, but I think these were debates that people were having at the time. You know,
let me throw a few names at you, okay? I think Max Kruse is probably one of the obvious ones when you think of German strikers.
Possibly his off the pitch antics were a factor in that.
That's definitely the factor, but should he have still been in that squad? Or is he too much of a midfielder?
Yeah, I think he would be an option, but again, you know, I think it would have been maybe one or two places, and you've got all these guys anyway. So I would have gone for Andre Hahn, to be honest. He would have been my pick.
What about Kevin Volland?
Didn't do enough last year, in my opinion.
Did Andre Schürrle do enough last year? Oh, well, you're saying he didn't.
Possibly not, but that's the place I'm taking.
Lukas Podolski, I suppose. Is the
yeah,
same.
True.
No, I mean, I think that's a fair point. In terms of personnel, the team, it did seem, I was quite surprised that someone like Julian Brandt wasn't brought in, even though Leroy Sané is. I know there's not much between them, but and a lot of people were complaining about, like, I think you're right when you said that there weren't enough players who were able to actually just take the ball and run at defences. I think that's what Draxler was brought into the team to do, and he did it to an extent, but maybe not enough. I thought actually, the interesting thing is that Mesut Ozil is an interesting player for me, because he's always played out wide or as a number 10, and the position that he takes up, that player is expected to take on defenders, but that's not really Mesut Ozil's game plan. I actually think Mesut Ozil actually reminds me a little bit of Zidane in the way that he's an attacking midfielder, but he doesn't really go past players. He's much better at picking passes and, you know, threading balls through. And I thought for a large part of this competition, he was actually very good for Germany, and just the style of player that he is, that you don't really pick up on that unless you go back through the game again.
But I think he's more effective in a wide position. No, I think when he plays in the 10 position, I know that it's kind of almost become like a kind of generalisation about Ozil's game, but I do think he goes hiding sometimes if he plays in the centre. So I think actually playing wide is fine, because he's got more room And it almost is like a better kind of view of the game. You know, when you're wide, you can, it, you obviously, it gives the team width, it allows Kimmich to move forward. And we saw, obviously, when Hoeveedus played it right back in the first game, there was just no balance to the team. And but when Kimmich comes in, gives them a higher position, Ozil was wide, you know, there was a bit, just a bit more fluidity to it.
The point I was going to make about Ozil was that you're right, he played well there, but the point I'm making is that when you play him on the right, it's in place of where a traditional winger could play. And then that meant that the only winger they had was Julian Draxler on the left-hand side. So, I mean, Germany only had one midfielder who could actually dribble with the ball and take on. And I actually thought Julian Draxler had a fine competition, considering he's actually played almost no part in the German setup at all going into the summer. And then he gets picked for the team on the back of a pretty solid season, actually, since joining Wolfsburg. And then just tasked with being the player who can actually dribble past defenders. But that's the point we're trying to make, is there weren't enough of those players in the team. You had Thomas Müller and Gomez up front. So yeah, you're right. I think that they do like those type of players.
Let's talk about the decision not to pick Marcel Schmelzer at left back. Jonas Hector didn't have a bad tournament, but he's clearly not a great player. He's clearly not a Philipp Lahm or, you know, someone like that. And that was almost kind of the responsibility, because in the tournament before, Philipp Lahm was asked to carry the ball forward, you know, to try and take on players in the last third, try and put cross into the box. And Jonas Hector did give them a lot of width. His final ball, more often than not, was pretty poor.
He infuriated me throughout the competition simply because he was the left-footed left-back, which Germany needed. But he kept getting down the line and would never cross the ball. I don't know if that was an instruction from Löw, because Germany like to play this style where they hold on to the ball, which means they just dance around the box for 10 minutes.
Sure.
But now and now that I just say that through, I'm thinking, well, then you can't really criticise Hector if he's been specifically told not to cross the ball. But that's exactly what they needed when they had Gomez and Thomas Müller in the box. And I think I agree with you entirely. I think Hector's an exceptionally average fullback. I've been amazed to read the rumours linking him with Liverpool and Barcelona for obscene amount of money. I don't think he's worth even 10 million euros, never mind 20. And I think there's just simply something there between Löw and Schmelzer. I think I can only suggest allegedly, because I honestly, off the top of my head, can't remember if it was confirmed, but there have been stories in the past between the two. They just simply don't get on. Löw doesn't want him in the squad. It's as simple as that. And although I think Schmelzer is actually an average fullback as well,
He's much better than Hector.
And they could have certainly used him, especially if he was playing alongside Hummels in that back
especially
line.
Coming off the season that he had.
He had a great season.
Obviously,
you probably argue actually that he was the best left back, because Rodriguez was horrendous at Wolfsburg.
Yeah.
And I mean, Alaba never played left back at Bayern. And I think Bernat was very average actually for Bayern Munich.
So before the tournament, obviously, Gundogan's injury was a massive blow as well. Why did Germany maybe not try to replace him in terms of his style? Now, I'm pointing specifically to Gonzalo Castro here. Gonzalo Castro was good enough to replace Gundogan in the Dortmund team, so why was Gonzalo Castro not good enough to replace Gundogan in the Germany team? Now, Castro and Löw must have some kind of beef going on here, because he has not been called up either. For the life of me, I cannot understand why he wasn't in the squad either, because he was outstanding when he was asked to replace Gundogan for Dortmund, who, you know, easily would have been a semi-final candidate in the Champions League.
Yeah,
you know,
I think maybe with Castro, it's simple that he's, up until very recently, he's been a Bayer Leverkusen player who plays in a position which is often dominated by the German national team, by players who play for Bayern Munich and Real Madrid.
True.
I know what you're saying, though. I mean, Gundogan's role for Germany is ultimately Schweinsteiger's old role.
And
when Schweinsteiger was injured and Gundogan was injured, you're right, Castro would have been a made at fair point. But instead, Löw decided to go with that the midfield two of Toni Kroos and Khedira. And I think Khedira's injury probably played a larger part than most people appreciate, because Khedira is actually considered this sort of defensive player, but he's the complete opposite. Actually, he's a box-to-box player who makes really late runs, and he does a lot of work to completely disrupt like the cohesion of the other team's defense, because he just makes so many runs forward.
Yeah.
And the problem is, when Khedira wasn't there to make those runs, the team as a whole didn't have that. When Schweinsteiger came into his role, And he just he doesn't have the legs to do that anymore. And what I actually noticed was, I'm trying to think, which game was it that Khedira actually went injured in? And Schweinsteiger came on. It's the Italy game.
Yeah, Italy.
I actually noticed that Schweinsteiger actually, rather than make the move forward, he actually kept slipping into the right-back role and telling Kimmich to move up, mm-hmm. which might work. But he's not facilitating that role that Khedira left, and which is one that Castro would have been perfectly positioned for.
Yeah, I mean, the player that, and there's not many midfield players like Gundogan in modern football, because the way that he, not even just in terms of making runs, but the way he can carry the ball and just penetrate those lines so easily, he's so good at it. And I'm not saying Castro is the only guy who's similar to him, but Castro can actually do that as well.
Yeah.
So I can't really understand why he wasn't in the squad, because for me personally, my team pre-tournament would have been Kroos, Khedira, Gundogan, Ozil wide, possibly a one-on-one player to the left, and then a striker.
Mm. Definitely not Thomas Müller.
Well, I mean, I've been on this Thomas Müller bandwagon for a long time, and the guy's clearly an outstanding football player, great anticipation, reads situations really well, but he's been terrible for the last 6 months, and it genuinely has been terrible. I mean, it's not even like an overreaction. For me, if you're picking the best 11 Germany players, he doesn't get into it right now.
On form.
It's been a long kind of phase of form though. It's probably because he's exhausted. I mean, I'm not saying that he's bad player, but it's clear that he wasn't giving a lot to the team. So if you take Thomas Müller out and you put in a Sané, maybe what you do is you give Thomas Müller an extended break and you say, look, we'll bring you into the tournament, but you'll have a break and we'll bring you in for when the big games require, because, you know, maybe Sané wouldn't have played against Italy. Maybe, I'll say ironically, the only time he did come on was against France.
Yeah. About 5 minutes.
Yeah, but maybe he wouldn't have played in that game, and maybe that was the kind of game that Thomas Müller would have thrived in. But yeah.
I mean, I'm not entirely sure if Sané is the solution, the long term solution to this problem. He might be. We've talked about Sané before. I'm not sure if he's been on this podcast, but talk a lot about him on Twitter. I actually think Julian Brandt might be a cleverer player, at least in terms of how he plays the game, but that kind of raw pace and that ability to actually run at players is something that Germany certainly lacked. And Thomas Müller's an interesting one, because I think you're right. I think he was clearly exhausted in that competition, but I don't think it was a personal thing. I think actually the thing I noticed quite early on was that a lot of the Bayern Munich players were exhausted. David Alaba was horrendous. Robert Lewandowski looked atrocious. In fact, Thomas Müller and Robert Lewandowski both looked quite similar in the way that they really struggled to actually... Mm. And it's not physical fatigue, because they could still run up and down the pitch. It was a mental fatigue. It's their touch let them down. They weren't making the same runs. They weren't finishing chances. They weren't offering assists. And in fact, interestingly enough, one of the few players that I noticed from Bayern who actually did look fresh was Jerome Boateng, and that might be simply because he missed half the season for Germany, or for Bayern Munich, from his injury in January. So in terms of Thomas Müller, it might be worth just putting that caveat that by and large Pep Guardiola's players just looked exhausted after the season they'd had. So so if that's you got anything else to say, we can probably move on to Louvre, perhaps.
Yeah, we almost kind of gone off on a tangent here. But all those, to me, those are the things I would take issue with in terms of his selection. So that's what we kind of started with, was, you know, the point of selections. I think those players should have been involved, Castro, Schmelzer, possibly Andre Hahn. But that's, again, totally subjective. What do you think of his decision to go with Mario Götze as the false nine from the start of the tournament?
It's interesting, because I think Löw's ideal Germany team are Spain, if I'm honest with you. At least Spain when they, not Spain now, but Spain in their heyday, which is a team that could pass through defences, it could hold on to the ball, and then when it mattered, they could make two or three quick transition passes on the edge of the box, and then before the defence even knows where they are, a quick 1-2 and they're one-on-one with the goalkeeper. In Löw's mind, in my opinion, that is exactly what Mario Götze offers as a false nine, in that in the box or on the edge of the box, and he's the player who can play the quick 1-2 with Thomas Müller or with Julian Draxler or Sami Khedira, and then he could be the player who turns and then finishes off the move. That's the only possible way I can imagine why Mario Götze continues to play for Germany. He won the World Cup with an outstanding goal. Unfortunately, as things seem to be going right now, that might be the only thing he's done in his... Well, not the only thing, but his defining thing in his career. It may tend, that may ultimately overshadow the rest of his career, actually. But
yeah,
in my opinion, that's the only way I can possibly imagine why he still gets some.
Yeah, I mean,
team.
I actually kind of defended the decision to play him as a false nine because from the players in the squad, I think he was probably the best option. And through qualification, we saw Mario Götze actually play pretty well. He played well for Germany in qualifying, and I think a large part of that was because he wasn't the guy who everyone was relying on to score a goal. Didn't have to, because he would make space, and you'd have Thomas Müller, Sharp, you'd have Gundogan there, you'd have Kroos pushing forward. I mean, that was a kind of big part of Germany's strategy during qualifying. Scotland-Germany game in particular comes to mind, because Götze played as a false nine against two big burly centre-halves. It was exactly the same as what Germany faced against Northern Ireland and Ukraine. But when you have players like Gundogan, and you have players like Müller and Kroos there, you have a bit more quality, a bit more penetration, and perhaps the exhaustion was a big part of it. I mean, it could be. I mean, certainly, I think...
He had no reason to be exhausted.
No, sure. But, I mean, I think for other players, but I mean, between the Italy game, between the France game, you could see that played a big part, I think, in the two games.
Well, when you look at it from a tactical point of view, the way that Germany are set up, a player like Götze makes perfect sense, because Germany have no problem controlling games. I think in every single game they played, they controlled possession. I was actually really impressed with the way they really managed to wrestle possession away from Italy. A lot of people really thought Italy were going to win that game, and I thought Germany had a really strong point.
They weren't far off it, though. I mean,
I know, but I think Germany had a really good point of course, went all the way to a penalty shootout, but I'm really impressed with the way that Germany really controlled large parts of it, and once again, just struggled to score goals. But when you look at this Germany team on paper, it's a team that has no problem controlling the ball, controlling possession, but what they really struggle is in that final third. And that's where someone like Mario Götze, who's a little unconventional with the way he makes runs, he can drag defenders out of position, he's got a great first touch, great passing ability in these tight areas. It makes perfect sense for someone like Mario Götze to be in that team playing that role, because he's the one who can come up with a little bit of magic to complement this really, really rigid defensive and midfield structure. But unfortunately, in practice, that didn't happen because, for one reason or another, Mario Götze just isn't really the player right now who Germany need him to be. In theory, on paper, you can understand why Löw stands by Götze, but it's not simple in real life.
Yeah, I mean, the Italy game, obviously, was a really defining point in the tournament, because up until that point, Germany kind of were in cruise control. The Italy game was really the first challenge, and obviously Italy coming off the back of the Spain.
I thought Poland, to an extent.
Yeah, but I mean, group stage game, but I mean, Italy coming off the back of beating Spain, all this, you know, reputation of Catenaccio, all that kind of thing.
Conte.
Yeah, so in this game, Jogi Löw actually changed his whole setup. You know, Germany went from, you know, typical 4-2-3-1 formation to 3 at the back, with Huvides in there, Kimmich as a wing-back. Jogi Löw came in for a lot of stick from Mehmet Scholl, who's the main kind of analyst on German public TV. He said that, you know, all this kind of focus on, you know, the philosophy in the last few years, all this focus on developing a certain type of player, and then all of a sudden Germany just changed their tactics completely. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I mean, I was really impressed with it. I wasn't entirely convinced it was necessary ahead of the game, but like I've just said, I was actually really impressed with the way that Germany actually handled that Italian team. I think the outcome of the game should have had huge ramifications on the confidence of the team, because Germany has this, or at least did, well, I guess it still does, because technically didn't win a game in 90 minutes against Italy. They have this mental block with the Italian national team, and then not only to win that penalty shootout, but to win it after so much drama. And it was interesting that Schweinsteiger chose to pick the end of the Italian team. Was quite impressive. And I thought at that point in the competition, Italy were easily at least the second best team, or the strongest opponents Germany could have played. And it would have made for a great final.
That's interesting. I would actually disagree. I kind of see what Scholl was saying. I think Germany were the favourites to win this tournament. They have the quality to go on and win this game. I think there was almost a sense of a fear about this Italian team. Germany didn't have to play 3 at the back against a 3-5-2. I mean, they didn't, you know.
Yeah, but it does help. I didn't think you had to.
Yeah, but I mean, I think Hummels and Boateng would have been capable of dealing with that situation themselves. I mean, they were up against Milik and Lewandowski in the group stages, for example. I understand that Pele is a really difficult player to play against, I didn't think Adair would have caused them a lot of problems. And I think they struggled to break down the kind of three. I mean, I totally understand Buffon, Barzagli, Bonucci, Chiellini. You know, you're not going to get much better than that. But they didn't really do much to penetrate in wide areas behind the wing-backs. I thought it was a game that was crying out for Sané, who could get some width on the pitch, beat players one-on-one. And to be honest, Germany probably should have gone out at that stage. They weren't great in the game. Extra time was a bit of a damp squib. They missed three of their five penalties. You know, if the Italians hadn't completely this could be a different story. We could be literally getting the knives out for Jogi Löw.
Yeah, I think. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think if Italy had beaten Germany at that point, I think there would have been huge criticism on Germany. I don't think you could say they should have went out. I think if they should have went out, they would have went out. I actually thought. Throughout this competition, Löw actually got his tactics spot on, by and large, in every game. I think he's very modest as a coach in terms of, you know, he's not like Sir Alex Ferguson, who would simply just put out the same formation and just expect his players through sheer fear and will to make up for it on the pitch. He's quite happy to accept that, yeah, you know what, we're Germany, we might be the world champions, but If Italy are playing this way, we're going to change things to make sure we try and beat them. And I thought that was fair. Actually, I know you may disagree. You make a good point. At certain points in that game, they were crying out for another forward to be offered more impetus in attack. But I actually thought the setup actually helped tackle Italy. You got to bear in mind that Italy were easily the most impressive team going into the competition, or at this point in the competition, and I thought Germany completely nullified them.
Yeah, but they weren't the best in the competition going forward, though. I mean, this is probably like, people were saying this was like the worst Italian team in decades, and this was only because Antonio Conte was the coach, right? And I know that they had a fantastic game against Spain, but is that not an admission that Germany's strategy in developing players has failed? If Germany cannot beat Italy by playing to their strengths, i.e. positional play, you know, penetrating opposition, you know, trying to score goals, if they can't do that against Italy, who were not a great side, then is that not a failing? Maybe not Jogi Löw's fault, but I mean, is that not an admission that something's not right?
Yeah, but one team who didn't change their tactics and thought, we've got the best squad, we're going to beat them, was Spain, and they went out to Italy. You know, I think it's far too much an oversimplification to say, oh, well, you know, this isn't a great Italy team, Germany should have beaten them. Conte, great coach, got the absolute best out of them, and this team were running through, you know, brick walls for him at this point, and they had a solid foundation, and just an entire setup which allowed them to take on teams like Germany. I mean, this Italy team was purpose-built to beat teams like Spain and Germany. I think the way that they beat Spain is how they probably would have beaten Germany if Germany had just gone into the game with their standard tactics.
But if the guy, your man Zaza, doesn't do his stupid dance and scores the penalty, Italy win.
Of course it's
fine margins, but what I'm saying is Germany's game plan wasn't a success because it went to a penalty shootout.
Oh yeah, I can accept that. They didn't win through their tactics, but they also didn't lose, you know. All I'm saying is that I think Löw deserves credit for, even though he's won the World Cup, rather than the way that Del Bosque hasn't really changed anything about that Spain team since they reached their heights, I think Löw is still a very modest man, and even though he might have some of the best players in the world, we did see him change things a lot. He's actually at this point quite comfortable in his own skin, and I think, for example, the way that he started Hovedes, maybe a little too comfortable perhaps for his pitch side behaviour, but for example, players like Hovedes, who he thought, right, we'll try this at right back, and it just did not work. And rather than stubbornly stand by his initial thoughts, he thought, no, okay, fair enough, let's put Kimmich in there. Now, you're right, maybe he should have brought Leroy Sané on earlier against France, or maybe he should have just dropped Thomas Müller after the second game and thought, no, this guy's just not having it. But I think he deserves credit by the fact that when he is wrong, by and large, he's quite happy to accept that, just move on. And we saw that throughout the World Cup competition as well, which is something I actually want to mention. So we've talked about largely... Well, before we do, actually, why don't you perhaps sum up the reaction that there has been in the German press after the competition, because a lot of our listeners are listening from the United States, the US, France, all over the world, really. So how has it been here in Germany?
Yeah, I think the manner of Germany going out against France when they'd actually played pretty well helped Jogilev a lot, because I think during the tournament the knives were out pretty fiercely. I mean, we mentioned Mehmet Scholl, for example, who generally was pretty critical of the Germany coach, but obviously with the Trousergate and all that kind of thing, there was a lot of negative.
What's Trousergate in German?
Trousergate, yeah, what the fuck was Hosentor or something like that. I think when all this negative press is going around and there was questions about, oh, you know, why are you still playing Mauro Götze? Why is Mauro Gomez not playing? Why is this happening? Why is them? The knives were kind of out for him quite early on, but I think there's a kind of acceptance to an extent. I wouldn't say an acceptance that the tournament was a success, but I think there's an acceptance that, you know, Germany did all they could and they lost to a superior, well, maybe not a superior French team, but they lost to a French team that took advantage.
I think that's fair. I mean, ultimately, you know, football is still, at the end of the day, just 22 guys on a pitch kicking a ball. It's not an exact science. It's not.
You're going to annoy a lot of people when you say things
like
that.
No, but it's not. It's not just pure maths. You can't just get all the factors right and win. Sometimes you are the better team. Sometimes you should have won, but you come off the pitch and you end up losing by 2 or 3 goals. And I think that's what happened with Germany. And I think you're right. I think by and large the press were sympathetic to that. My next point would be to ask you then is how much of that is down to the fact that they had won the World Cup 2 years beforehand?
Yeah, I think a part of it probably was, Germany. I mean, for a generation of people, Germany hadn't won the World Cup. You know, I think this was a huge moment in German football history. The fourth time, obviously, they'd won the World Cup, and to do it as well in South America when I don't think Germany really were expected to win the World Cup. I mean, Brazil were obviously the massive favourites, home country, and the way that Germany dispatched Brazil 7-1, it's incredible. And again, narrow margins going into the final. I mean, it went all the way to extra time, and Germany came out on top. I mean, I think that's a big part of it. Which is not, I'm not saying that's a negative thing, because, you know, anyway, this is what Germany have worked towards. This is why they changed the development system. This is why the whole academy system was reformed. Because they wanted to be world champions, and they were. I think they'll be disappointed that they've not had the same kind of longevity of success like Spain had. I mean, Spain obviously won a World Cup and 2 European championships. Germany never really had that kind of success. Mm. So that's something that will be interesting to see how it goes on. And obviously, Jogi Löw will be the coach for 2018, we think, at Russia. I would ask you, I mean, do you think that's the right decision? Do you think it should be? Do you think Germany should think about trying something else?
I guess at this point we can really just lay our cards on the table and what we both think of Löw. And I think, by and large, I think you'd probably right to stick around with him. Maybe if there was a Jurgen Klopp or Jupp Heynckes on the sidelines who wanted the job, then you might think, oh, well, okay, maybe. Mm-hmm. Although I'm not sure Heynckes is a great long-term prospect to move to. If a player of that quality or a coach of that quality was offering their services, it might be worth thinking about taking a new direction. But I think by and large, I actually think Löw's done a good job at Germany. Sure, on paper, it's Germany. They always have to at least reach a semi-final, and that's exactly what he's done. But the manner in which they won that World Cup, I thought was really quite impressive. And I thought that the manner in which they won the World Cup, again, largely played a part in how they played this competition. I thought they were solid from the back. And I thought Löw was quite smart in the way that he did make slight changes throughout the competition. Ultimately, he was let down by injuries. I think if Khedira is in that team against France, I think it's a completely different situation. Boateng, Mats Hummels. I mean, it was just one thing after another. Manuel Neuer making an uncharacteristic farce for a goal. It just comes down to luck at the end of the day, and I think Löw isn't a man who seems to take himself too seriously. In terms of, you know, the expectation he puts on himself, I think after that he'd be quite happy to sit back and think it was just bad luck. So I think by and large I'm quite happy that he's sticking around. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. I think Louvre is almost like a kind of chess piece in the overall thing. I mean, it's important to emphasise, and I think it was this is why Germany did so well in the 2014 World Cup, is that the structure they have at the DFB is so good. You know, Hansi Flick is there, Oliver Bierhoff. They have a really top management structure, a top analysis team. I mean, they have a university in Cologne that's basically giving them all the data they need. So, I mean, they have an incredible advantage over, let's say, England, for example. But yeah, I think to have that kind of continuity is a good thing. I think Germany are in a good place, but it's important that they evolve. It's important that the team evolves. You know, guys like Julian Weigl by that time will be, you know, 22, 23. Kimmich will have two more years of experience at Bayern Munich. Potentially might not play under Ancelotti, we don't know. So I think, yeah, for me, I think that makes complete sense.
So both of us are quite happy for him to stick around.
Yeah.
Okay, well, just to take a break from listening to two dire Scots talking, we have managed to invite a third, a good friend to the podcast, Graham Muthven, international sports reporter, who covers a wide range of leagues, teams, clubs, competitions in the sport for a number of publications, to the very highest of publications. He was quite happy to come on the podcast and really give us an outsider international perspective as to how Yogi Löw and Germany are perceived outside of, well, Germany. As you know, we wanted to get you on the podcast because Ross and I have just been talking for the best part of an hour about what we think Löw has done at Germany, and that kind of represents largely, at least what we think, is the general perception in Germany, at least people who spend enough time digging through the weeds of what he's done at the national team. First of all, I'll ask you very basically, I mean, how do you think Germany did this summer?
Well, they certainly, I think, performed below expectations, certainly what I expected of them. I mean, as world champions, you're kind of going into a major tournament expecting them to put up a good defence, and to a certain extent, they did do that. They got to semi-finals, so I don't think it was an abject failure in any way, but they fell short, and they had a team that was not really very much there. I mean, I know that Lahm wasn't there and Klose wasn't there, so two key players that were so important for them in 2014. But other than that, it was quite a similar team they had. Schweinsteiger was still there as well. So, I mean, it wasn't like there was a huge amount of change. So you would kind of expect them to have done a little bit better, I think.
And does that failure to reach at least the expectations you put on them, is that down to the squad or is that down to the manager?
Well, I think first thing to say is Germany did get a little bit unlucky in that the injuries they got for the semi-final in particular were really unfortunate, and it was quite similar, to me anyway, it seemed to be quite a similar trend to 2014, and that Löw came into the tournament not wanting to play an out-and-out target man, then kind of realised that he needed to do that, and Gomez was the close figure this time round, and while Klose worked in 2014 and took them all the way to the title, Gomez got an injury, and I don't think they were the same team without a kind of focal point of attack. I think that Germany team needs someone to kind of play off. They've got a lot of players that to me seem to be very similar, and that doesn't work when they don't have a central striker, so you could say that early on in the tournament, Löw was to blame for not playing Gomez from the start, and I think it took until the third game of the group, I think, maybe, or maybe even the last 16 game to start him. So you could say that he could be blamed for that, but in terms of the semi-final, it's difficult to really blame Löw, I think, for the way that they lost to France. However, you know, a truly top-tier coach, a truly exceptional manager, would find a way to get past that. I mean, Germany's team was still good enough to make it past France to get through to the final. So, you know, you can't really blame Löw, but it didn't really make a case for him as an elite manager that he wasn't able to find a solution to that problem.
So you think a better coach may have been able to work around France?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I think it's... Löw isn't a bad coach by any stretch. There's no denying that. He's won the World Cup, and I don't think you can win the World Cup if you're a bad coach. But he's very much par for the course at international level. I think international football, with the exception of Antonio Conte, who's of course now gone to Chelsea. Elite coaches don't seem to take international jobs, and Love is, I think, a perfect example of that. He's kind of the breed of these managers who, international football specialists who haven't ever managed in club football, and someone like Mark Wilmots at Belgium as well is of that breed. He is very much the precedent for that. But the problem for Germany is who would they really get to replace Löw? Who is better that's out there? I mean, if you were asking me who the ideal candidate is, it would be the last man to really take a German team and mould all their attacking threats all together and make a really exceptional unit was Jupp Heynckes. But of course, he's been retired for a while now, so you know, that's probably unrealistic to say he would take it. But other than him, there's not really a candidate that stands out for me. So that's part of the problem.
It's interesting you mentioned Conte there and moving to Chelsea, because very briefly, Löw was linked with positions in the Premier League when there was still some ambiguity over his future at Germany. I think he was linked with Arsenal. I guess that's just a rite of passage for any coach these days, it would seem. Do you think that, I mean, let's not say Arsenal, because it's hard to say whether any coach would be any good there, but in terms of where you think his talents lie, do you think he'd be good enough to coach one of the best teams in the Premier League?
It's difficult to say, because I don't think he makes the... At international level, I think you're looking for a coach who makes the most of what he has. That's always the gauge, international level, because of course there's no transfer market, so it's impossible to know how Löw would deal with the transfer market. So every international coach is really gauged, is really measured on how they make the most of what they have. And I don't think Löw is really... I mean, in 2014 he did, because of course they won the World Cup. They thumped Brazil in the semi-final, so of course that's pass marks. But with the team that Germany have, I think they've probably got the best squad in world football, alongside probably Spain. That's kind of the level that's expected of them, especially at the moment when there's not really a huge amount of really good international teams. So it's kind of a lose-lose for Löw, because if he wins everything... If he'd won the European Championships this summer and had won the World Cup 2 years ago, then you'd go, well, that's what's expected of a team like Germany. So I don't know how... It's difficult to know how he would deal with a club team, because, you know, with Germany, I don't think he's made the most of that team, and that's really the only measure you have at international football. You look at someone like Conte with that Italy team, I know they got knocked out earlier than perhaps expected, but they came up against Germany quite early, and you would say Conte probably made the most of what he had there. So in that sense, you can see why Conte would be more of a success in club football than Yogi Löw.
Obviously, you've been quite thorough in your own opinion of Löw. You are based in the United Kingdom, you do a lot of work for the US media, you do a lot of work within Spanish football as well, and just European football in general. I mean, rather than outside of your own opinion, how do you think Löw's regarded around the continent and perhaps internationally?
I think in England he is rated quite highly, but that might be because England have done so poorly that they look at Germany and look at how you know, the criticism that Löw faces, and they wish they had some of the problems that Germany had. I mean, when you consider that early on in the tournament, the biggest controversy Germany seemed to face was the fact that Löw, you know, couldn't stop smelling his hands after they'd been in rather unsavoury places, and compare that to the controversies that England had. I mean, you know, it's not exactly a big problem, but Germany are more is expected of them, so it's all relative. In the US, the opinion of Löw is that he was the mastermind behind Klinsmann's success, because Klinsmann now is really a little bit of a figure of fun in American soccer. He's not highly rated, despite the fact they did relatively well at the 2014 World Cup. Klinsmann seems to be the beginning of the end for him. There are a lot of people calling for his head. He hasn't changed the American game in the way they expected him to. So they've kind of been exposed to Klinsmann, you know, and his ways and his methods, and they kind of have come to the opinion that it was actually all Löw behind the scenes as his assistant manager. in 2006 and then the couple of years preceding that, he was the man who did it all. So I think Love is quite highly rated generally outside Germany. I mean, I don't know what you and Ross have been talking about earlier about the opinion of him inside Germany, but outside Germany, I think he's rated quite highly. But whether that would translate into him doing well in a club job, I'm not so sure. There is certainly scepticism and criticism of Love, but you know, when you look at someone like the criticism that Mark Wilmot's had for, you know, failing with that Belgium team, he's lost his job. It doesn't compare.
Okay, great. Well, thanks very much for giving us that perspective on Love. I think that should offer some interesting insight to listeners who are interested in how he's regarded around the world, especially in the United States. So thanks for coming on the podcast, and hopefully we can have you on again sometime. Okay, so I think we've covered Love quite extensively. I think we've covered the past, the recent past, and the World Cup from 2 years ago quite extensively as well. Ross, let's sum things up by taking a very brief, quick look towards the future. Now, it's almost impossible, and some might say pointless, trying to predict how football goes. But going into the next 2 years, going into the World Cup, the next line of qualifying games for Russia 2018, let's take a look at, you know, how this Germany team is going to change over the next 2 to 4 years, and how Löw will hopefully get the best out of that. So yeah, looking at this German national team, Ross, where do you see changes being made? Where do you see new players coming through? And how do you think this team is going to look in 2 years' time?
Yeah, I think the transition from this kind of crop of players to the next crop is going to be quite difficult, because I don't see a huge amount of young players coming through who might hit the requisite quality right away. I think there maybe has to be a little bit of an in process. Like 2010 South Africa was just a case of getting Thomas Müller and Mesut Özil, that kind of experience at that level. It'll be interesting to see through qualification against like the Czech Republic, Norway, Northern Ireland, whether we see the likes of Julian Weigl get a more prominent role in the team, Joshua Kimmich. The problem is really, I mean, do you drop Toni Kroos? No, you can't really. So guys like Toni Kroos and Gundogan are going to be there, injuries permitting, of course, with Gundogan. These guys are going to be the kind of core for the next World Cup. I'm curious about forward positions. Mm. Forward positions are really interesting because, as I said in the part about Euro 2016, I think there's a big kind of flaw in Germany's overall game plan was, you know, the kind of one-on-one type players with a little bit of ingenuity. Centre forwards is a big problem. European football in general is not producing a lot of those players, which it's going to be very interesting to see how that pans out at the 2018 World Cup. I think depending on, I mean, obviously with Sané going to Man City, potentially that's a big question mark about his development. It could go completely both directions. We don't know. I think Julian Brandt is in a good position at Leverkusen. I think if he stays there, plays regularly, you know, gets Champions League football, I think he could be a big part of the next qualifying campaign. Like Draxler has been in recent years when he's been kind of bed in. I think Brandt could be that kind of player. Centre forward, yeah, that's a big kind of question mark. Germany have not really produced any players of note in that position.
Well, Kevin Volland's now at Leverkusen, where you'd think he'd push on. Yeah.
But it's still a big question mark, though, you know.
Sure, but that seems to be the move that everyone's been expecting him to make for quite some time, so maybe he can. I mean, for me, I find it quite interesting because if we do go to the 2018 World Cup with this squad full of, you know, three or four players who are now considered young, well, then we'll be considered senior players, and then Germany go on to win that World Cup, this Euro 2016 might actually be considered the transition period between the two generations, because some of the largest narratives going into the competition was Bastian Schweinsteiger is now too old, Philipp Lahm has retired and no one has replaced him. And in my opinion, that's where the real crux of the problem is. Who are going to be the new Bastian Schweinsteiger and who's going to be the new Philipp Lahm? I thought a large part of the manner in which Germany actually won the World Cup was because by that point, Bastian Schweinsteiger and Philipp Lahm had confirmed and they convinced themselves that they were of the highest pedigree. They'd finally won the Champions League with Bayern Munich, and they were playing for one of the best teams in the world. And Bastian Schweinsteiger went to Brazil that summer convinced that he was one of the best players in the world, and he dominated midfield positions for that. And I thought Philipp Lahm, despite playing some roles in midfield as a right back, looked like his old reliable self. Germany have got a huge task on their hands in how they replace those players. Now, you're right, Toni Kroos and Sami Khedira probably will take those roles, but I'm really interested in how, for example, Joshua Kimmich and Julian Weigl come through. In 2 years' time, are they going to be these world beaters who, I mean, I thought Joshua Kimmich looked really strong in that right-back position throughout the World Cup.
Yeah, no, I completely agree.
Is he going to keep that role for Bayern Munich? I mean, it might not matter. He might be able to play central midfield to Bayern Munich. Or,
but will he? I mean,
well, yeah, of course.
But you look at the sort of depth that Bayern Munich mm-hmm. have, I mean, it's pretty unlikely, to be honest. I mean,
he could end up just staying a right-back for Bayern, who's the Rafinha they've got.
Yeah.
And also, and he's actually, is he not left, maybe?
So
that's why I'll be interested. I'll be interested in seeing how Kimmich goes from being a young player to a really, not a proven player, but a player who's maybe, we really need these players to grow. And it for me, the Germany's greatest asset hasn't really been their technical ability or, you know, their physicality. It's the fact that this team, at least it did when Schweinsteiger and Lahm were in, it had this mental toughness. They didn't break under pressure, because most of the team had already proven themselves in the European Championship or the European Champions League. I think that's what makes the difference between a team like Bayern, Germany and perhaps England. England has a lot of talented players, but none of them have really proven their pedigree at the highest level. So when the pressure's really on, they crumble. While players like Toni Kroos, I mean, Toni Kroos at no point in that competition ever looked phased. In the same, I think, of Bastian Schweinsteiger and Philipp Lahm, Löw's task now in the next 2 years is to replace those players. I think that will be Joshua Kimmich. It will hopefully be Julian Weigl. I don't know how many Champions Leagues he'll win at Dortmund over the next two seasons, or even titles in total. But these are the players that Germany really need to see come on. And like you see, Leroy Sané, if he does go to Manchester City, you would hope that that's specifically because Pep Guardiola wants him and he can develop, and that would be fantastic for a German point of view. And Julian Brandt as well.
I mean, outside of those players who were involved in the kind of debate around the Euro 2016, I mean, obviously with the Olympic squad, again, a lot of players are in that with a kind of view to developing them for potentially 2018 World Cup. Brandt is obviously one of them. Max Meyer, interesting to see how he progresses under Marcus Fancio. Goretzka, I'm not sure Goretzka would be good enough to play for the German national team, but we'll see. An attack, Davy Selke. I mean, Leipzig obviously coming into the Bundesliga next year. We're going to be talking about Leipzig quite a lot over the next 2 years up until 2018. If they have a good season, guys like Davy Selke, they're going to be talked about as being potential options for Germany.
There's also Mac Madud, who had to pull out of the Olympic squad for the Gladbach's Champions League qualifiers. But just the sheer progress he's made for Gladbach last season is outstanding. And if he can continue that, you know, ascension, then there's absolutely no way that Germany can... I mean, Germany aren't ignoring him, of course. He's been under 21s, under 23 squads. But if he continues that form for Gladbach, he'll undoubtedly be a key player in 2 years' time. The problem is, though, and as you say, they do have players like Gundogan and Khedira, but both of those players do have histories with injury. I mean, we've been saying Gundogan's been a great player for maybe 3 or 4 years now, and at no point has he ever been relied upon for a national team.
I mean, also you have the factor in that Podolski won't be there next World Cup, Gomez won't be there. So there are positions in forward areas that need to be filled.
Yeah.
So that's going to be very interesting, because right now there are not a lot of obvious candidates. You mentioned Kevin Volland. I think that's a good example. Players like that will have time to develop, and I think over the next World Cup campaign, in terms of qualifying, we'll see these guys kind of slowly come in. And inevitably in 2 years' time, there will be players that we maybe didn't think about now. I mean, so interesting to see how it pans out.
I mean, I think Lovo is fortunate in the sense that if we can call the team that won the World Cup the Golden Generation, I know we can, it's not the right term, but if we call that team the Golden Generation, that generation of players weren't all of the same age. So even if, you know, undoubtedly Schweinsteiger and Lahm will be gone, at that point, Neuer, Hummels, Boateng, Kroos, Ozil, Müller, they'll still be the right side of 30. They'll still be approaching their peak. So he will still have that spine of players that he can rely on, a spine of players who have proven themselves at the very highest level and won the World Cup. So there's no reason to be pessimistic. It's just how he molds these fringe players and how they themselves can go on and prove themselves for their club sides. Because like you say, we need Leroy Sané playing either every day or every game for Schalke or Man City. We need Joshua Kimmich playing a vital role for Bayern Munich. And I think he will. You're right, Bayern have signed a whole number of central midfielders, but at right back or centre midfield, Germany could use him. Mr. Lowe, you're welcome. Yeah. We have
gone through the post-mortem.
Gone through the
cause of death has been confirmed.
And we have found a solution.
Yeah,
so. Job done.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, well, that's the full-time whistle on this podcast. We would really appreciate any reviews on iTunes, any shares on Twitter. I'm at RostonBar93. You're at
SBNkowski.
If you're interested in previous episodes, for example, we have looked at Pep Guardiola's time at Bayern Munich. We've looked at what Thomas Tuchel was doing at Borussia Dortmund. We've looked at the marketing potential of St. Pauli and Bayer Leverkusen. All of those podcasts are available. And until next time,
ciao.
Ciao.